Hi folks, Barry here. Just before you listen to our episode about the world's worst cleaner with playwright Tati Hennessy, a couple of quick parish notices. As ever, if you want to help support the podcast, we would appreciate, Ben and I both, if you could chuck us a few quid on patreon.com. We do bang on about it, but it is literally the way we pay to keep the lights on here at Worstwood Forward, and we are very grateful to those who are already able to support us. And if you are able to do so, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward. Check out all the different rewards. You'll get extra content, first access to various announcements and so on. It is well worth whatever amount that you feel able to part with. If you're not in a position to do so, obviously that's absolutely fine. We appreciate you listening to the show. And if you can give us a review on iTunes of 5 stars, of course, being the standard number of stars, that would be lovely. And recommend us to a friend on social media if you can, on @worstfoot on Twitter, or send them the way of our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. As Ben alluded to last week, we have another live show coming up in the springtime. We have a couple of really awesome guests nailed down, ready to go, and high ambition for the third. So if they all come off, it'll be a really, really amazing night. Full details, as Ben alluded to, will be announced in due course. You've got to bear with us a little bit longer. But rest assured, when tickets are available, we will be talking about nothing else for months to come. The last sort of thing we did before lockdown, the very first COVID lockdown, was we did the live show, our very first live show at Vault Festival in February 2020. And we just did the live show last month at Backyard Comedy Club in London. And I have to say, both of those have been just my favourite experiences with the podcast. It's really lovely getting to see people who listen to us in the flesh. It reminds us why we do the show, and it's lovely to encounter the people who we bring silliness and joy to week on week. And we really appreciate you all. So thank you for that. Anyway, before I get too sincere, let's dive into this week's episode, all about the world's worst cleaner.
Hello friends, welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me engendering to get spick and span in preparation for this week's episode. Now, I'm not going to lie, friends, here at Worst Foot Forward headquarters, I am surrounded by the stained evidence of my misdemeanours, so you're going to need to help me out here. Is it red wine or white wine that you put on fox's blood to get it out of a pristine ivory carpet? I never really know. And then it's vermouth on the entrails of an orphan that you sacrifice to the Dark Lord. And then I believe just a little bit of fever tree tonic that you use on a burst colostomy bag. I'm pretty sure that's what. And then you dab gently at all the stains, and when you realise that isn't going to help, you set fire to the entire building, salt the earth, and buy a new house. I think that's probably the cleaning hack that I'm going to go for this week. Anyway, so long as I get it all done before Mum and Dad come home, we'll be absolutely fine. And alongside me is the Henry to my Hoover, the Vortex to my Dyson, and the dabbing gently yet ineffectually at stains that just will not go away with a wire wool brush to my, please let me get away with this, it's Barry McStay.
We both look like wire brushes. I'm a bit more like a wire sponge. You've got sort of the full-blown mop head look at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Together, we are 2/5 of the cleaning family.
Yeah. My very first play had a scene where someone spills red wine, and there's a whole 3-minute shouting match between people suggesting various ways of cleaning it up, including finding a bottle of white wine to open and pour it on top of it, which I think it's always salt or white wine. I can never remember which one you're meant to do.
I'm pretty sure it is white wine on a carpet and salt on a wound, because there's nothing worse than when someone's cut open their arm and you pour a nice Riesling on, they're like, oh, that doesn't really pair with my flesh wound.
Are you a neat person?
No.
Good. are you having it drummed into you by your wife, though?
No. The thing is, I've never been, like, repulsively untidy.
Oh no, hang on, because not every listener will remember, but about 4 years ago we did an episode on the world's worst lodgings, and you admitted that the room you lived in university was basically a pit.
It was a different life, it was a different time, I was a different person.
Okay.
I have become pretty good at becoming quite a neat and tidy cleaner. Admittedly, the difference between me, a normal human being, and my wife, when she's cleaning, goes full Swiss finishing school matron, who is one step away from getting the white glove out. But I've learned that she has standards that cannot be matched, but the fact that I even attempt to get there is admirable, yeah. I believe.
A for effort.
Yeah.
I very helpfully, I mean, it's a hindrance in lots of other ways, but I've got quite bad dust allergies. So anytime the dusting and the hoovering needs to be done, I can very legitimately ask my husband to do it for me.
You lazy prick.
Listen, we need a third member of this cleaning trio. Our guest this week is a playwright, dramaturg and screenwriter whose training includes the Royal Court Theatre Playwriting Course and Channel 4 Screenwriting Programme. Her plays include an adaptation of Animal Farm for the UK's National Youth Theatre, the highly successful 100 Words for Snow, which has been performed around the world, and most recently her thriller Something Awful, which she's currently adapting for television. Animals, trivia, awfulness. She'll be perfect on this podcast. She also confessed to not really liking providing personal bios and very kindly confessed some personal failures to me in lieu of professional credits. So, while fundraising for a show, she was once ghosted by two different sperm banks. To research 100 Words for Snow, she went to the Arctic with two left gloves and was so embarrassed she risked frostbite by not telling anybody. And she once applied to be on the TV show MasterChef and was rejected. But fear not, because on today's show, we'll be asking you to cook a guinea fowl roulade with a crispy caballonero and boysenberry jus. She should have no trouble making some decent potatoes, given her first name, a joke for the Scottish listeners there. Please welcome Tati Hennessy.
Thank you so much. And I don't even have to make awkward small talk with Greg Wallace. This is perfect.
I have it on authority, good authority, that Greg Wallace is one of the worst humans.
I mean,
that's why we've not done that episode.
Yeah. I mean, when I say one of the worst humans, he's not Pol Pot. Although, obviously, we'd all like to see Pol Pot's hot pot on MasterChef.
I don't want to know what Greg Wallace's killing fields are, though. Dictatorship doesn't get tougher than this.
Baked dictatorship doesn't get better than this. One of my friend's dads is a grocer, which is what Greg Wallace used to be.
Oh, that's so funny. He never mentions it on the show.
Yeah.
Now listen, obviously the sperm bank question is on everybody's lips.
Yeah, I know, right? Rude. What's the Oscar Wilde coat to be ghosted by one sperm bank is unfortunate. I believe that's what he's referring to.
I think, yeah, I have nothing to declare but my ovaries.
Yeah. You have a question about that, Barry, do you? I wonder why. Yeah.
How are you fundraising via sperm bank? You know that they don't actually have money.
Oh, this is my
That's
mistake.
A different type of bank.
This is my I wondered about the logistics of getting the money in there. No, it was a play about sperm donation, so it was thematically resonant, we thought, and we're self-producing and writing to, you know, in that panicky way you do when you have to raise money for a show. We were writing to everyone we could think of and wrote to some fertility banks thinking that they might like to sponsor us. And two seemed really keen and then didn't seem so keen and ignored all my emails. Even one where I had donated my own eggs. So really, I feel like they, you know, they owed me, I think. I gave them my gram of flesh and they gave me nothing. I don't know if it's a gram. I have no idea how much an egg weighs.
I'm going to say that if your eggs weigh a gram, that there's going to be some fairly hefty human beings.
I hope so. Oh, I hope so. Wouldn't that be great? I wonder if I'm going to know the kid who came from my egg. Oh, there they are. They're huge. They're giant. They are climbing the gherkin right now.
Well, we've found out that you're obviously very good at attracting and then unattracting the wrong kind of people. What are you not so good at?
Well, this was a really fun opportunity, thank you both, for looking at everything I've ever failed at in my life and thinking about what the common denominator might be. And I think the common denominator in all of them is that I really fail at recovering from failure. So you know how people say, oh, it doesn't matter how many times you fall, it's how many times you get back up. But if I fell down in a public place, I would pretend that it's because I fainted, and then I would never go back to that place ever again.
That quote always really annoys me, because it does matter how many times you fall, because how many times you get back up is exactly proportional to how many times you fall.
Well, I don't know. Can I count when I just get back up from sleeping or from sitting down? Because then I'm winning. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, right.
then I'm on the up. It's great.
Yeah. So rejection's not ideal for you then?
Well, I think it's sort of about the public thing. So I failed my driving test 15 years ago and I've just never got back behind the wheel of a car. It's too mortifying. Like, I don't deal well with the public humiliation.
Where did they conduct your driving test? Was it on was it at Silverstone on Formula One day?
You know, when you're 16 and you feel like you're neon, like that feeling of just everyone is looking at me and I'm completely visible and hyper visible. That's how it felt behind the wheel of that little whatever car it was. I still don't know anything about cars. I mean, I did fail the test basically before I turned the engine on, so it was a pretty catastrophic failure, and they were right to fail me. But I've never
gone
back.
Before turning the engine on.
Yes.
How's that even possible?
She asked me, how would you check the handbrake is working? And I took the handbrake off and we rolled down a hill nearly into traffic.
I really like the thought of your driving instructor or your driving tester turning to you and going, I'm very sorry, Mrs. Hennessy, but you have failed. And you being able to turn back to them and go, thank you. That is absolutely the correct decision.
Yeah,
it was totally correct. I mean, really, it would have been on them if they'd passed me. It would have been an egregious failure of a duty.
Oh, I'd love it if you could do that. Like, you know, the odd famous example in football of a penalty being wrongly awarded. And so a very sportsmanlike footballer going, that's not a penalty, or I'll just roll it to the goalkeeper. Of you going, are you mad? No, don't give me my driving license. Please take this back.
I absolutely would not have done that. I would have taken the license and I would have run.
Because you weren't allowed to drive.
I would not be allowed to drive. I still would have been too afraid to drive.
So this week, on the behest of Tati, we are talking about the world's worst cleaner. And Barry, you're going to go first.
I am indeed. I read, first of all, about the origin of spring cleaning.
Nice.
Yeah. There's lots of different suggested reasons why the term spring cleaning exists and why people... But there certainly is, through history, lots of examples of different civilizations and groups of people doing a big clean in the springtime. Persian New Year falls on the first day of spring, Nowruz. It's an Iranian tradition to this day. People do have the practice of kane tikani, which is literally shaking the house just before Persian New Year. The Jewish tradition, you're obviously meant to clean the house in anticipation of Passover.
In fact, what you're meant to do, what you might be about to say this, is that you are ceremonially on the night before Passover, leave 10 pieces of bread hidden around the house, and then you go around with a candle and a feather, which and pick them up. And let me tell you, my friends, that as a not very dexterous 6-year-old, trying to mop up a bit of crusty bread with a feather takes too long.
While holding a candle.
While holding a candle in between your teeth. And I'm pretty certain in my parents' old house, there is still one piece of bread somewhere in a nook or cranny that I was never able to retrieve.
Yeah, it's shametz. Is that the...
Chometz.
Chometz. There you are.
Shametz. Absolute philistine.
Oh, wait till I get onto the traditional Irish cleaning and see how good you are pronouncing that, Ben.
No, it's very simple. Every Irish word looks horrifying and is pronounced Siobhan.
Oh, so the Jewish tradition of Siobhan, hunting the crumbs by candlelight. But that hunt for the crumbs is because you're not meant to have any food in the house at all ahead of the fast. Is that right? That sort of is a symbolic version of that, by actually putting crumbs down to take them back up again.
It's an incredibly messy person. I love that tradition. That's what I'm going to claim that I'm doing every time I leave a biscuit where it shouldn't be. That's brilliant.
It's a Jewish holiday that I'm preparing for.
Yeah.
The Catholic Church, you usually clean the church altar on Maundy Thursday, which is the day before Good Friday in the spring. And in basically the more temperate, wet climates in North America and Northern Europe, in the sort of the industrial periods, it's the best time to clean after, you know, the long winter and having fires throughout the winter and coal smoke and candles and all of that, because sort of March, it's not too hot for insects to be a problem, and it's not really too cold, so it just seems the ideal time to open up the house and air it and try and clean it up. Then I read a bit about some Victorian cleaning products and Victorian cleaning methods.
Oh, yeah.
A housekeeping manual from the Victorian era suggested the following ingredients for if you needed to clean the house: carbolic soap, metal polish, bicarbonate of soda, black lead, beeswax, turpentine, benzene, emery paper, and disinfectant. So already you're onto a George's Marvelous Medicine style medicine cabinet. For dusting, actually, this would be quite good for Hamets, Ben. For dusting, they suggested you use white bread. In the Victorian time, the working classes had more things. You know, you were able to have a few more decorative knickknacks and books and soft furnishings and so on. So there was more dust and it was harder to clean dust. And an ostrich feather duster was the item to have. But ostrich feathers, obviously, reasonably expensive. But because the shape of ostrich feathers had, they've got little barbs in them, so they're very good at gathering dust. But the suggestion is that poorer people who couldn't afford a feather duster, white bread is ideal. You just squish it up into a ball and run it along the edge of picture frames or skirting boards or whatever. And it picks up the dust.
But then you've got a sandwich and you're ready to go.
You could pair it with what you do for cleaning your floors, because apparently damp tea leaves is the way to do that. Get damp tea leaves, sprinkle them on the floor, and they settle the dust. The dampness sort of lets the dust gather and embed in it, and then you sweep the leaves up again with a scrubbing brush. And Mrs. Beaton gets in the act. If it all sounds very, like, foodie, Mrs. Beaton suggests a recipe for furniture polish.
Wow.
Equal proportions of linseed oil, turpentine, vinegar, and spirits of wine. Shake the mixture well, rub on the furniture with a piece of linen rag, and polish with a clean duster.
I'm pretty sure that I've had a salad at a hipster restaurant that's been dressed with that.
Yeah. And obviously loads of Victorian stuff had poison in it, and cleaning products were no different. Arsenic and strychnine were very common ingredients in cleaning products. And, you know, the idea of microbes was a sort of a new thing in the Victorian era. So they were fascinated by germs, and they knew germs could be invisible now, basically. And so they came up with all sorts of chemical cleaning products and were big in advertising them. But they had, you know, things like carbolic acid and things in them. And they would sell caustic soda in boxes that looked exactly like baking powder. Like, exactly. In September 1888, the Aberdeen Evening Express reported 13 people had been poisoned by carbolic acid in one incident. 5 people died. A mere 14 years later, they passed the Pharmacy Act in the UK, making it illegal for bottles of dangerous chemicals to be similar in shape to ordinary liquids.
It's a dampener on the bake sale, doesn't it? 13 people dying. That's...
Yes.
Were the fairy cakes worth it?
But the church hall has a new roof now,
yeah,
so...
So, swings and roundabouts.
I also read about... Have you heard of a fluffer?
Go on.
Not the now defunct job in the porn world, since Viagra's been invented. Not that type of fluffer. But on the London Underground, you have fluffers, also known as tunnel rats. It's the name given to people who go along cleaning the tracks, because the way the trains move through the tunnel, it draws in rubbish and dust and all sorts of stuff. And they're a fire hazard because, you know, electrified lines and loads of bits of fluff and debris lying around. So in the sort of 4.5 hours you have every night between the tracks being turned off and the tracks being turned back on again, you have a team of people who go down the tunnels to try and clean it all up. And it's traditionally been a role carried out largely still by women. And they do it to this day. They've electric torches and protective clothing nowadays. And they collect the dust in plastic bags. But even in the beginning, in 1947, there was a newsreel by British Pathé showing fluffers with their carbide lamps and long brushes and scraping tools and loading up stuff into rubbish bins. And they have a trolley that runs on the rails with them to put all the stuff in.
Where is the big Netflix UK horror series about this?
There's a 1989 documentary called The Heart of the Angel. Molly Dineen chronicled the work of the team of fluffers at Angel Station in Islington. It is very much the opening for some sort of horror series or like a Trapped in a Room movie,
yeah.
One of those things. Before I get onto my world's worst cleaner, a cleaner invented the Olympic Games.
Really?
Go on.
Not the Baron de Coubertin, but Hercules.
Oh, because he cleaned the stables.
Because he cleaned the Aegean stables, yes, the fifth labour of Hercules. Eurystheus, who was the guy who was setting all the labors for Hercules, he asked him to clean the stables of Aegeus in one day. Aegeus was the king of an area called Elis, who had 3,000 cattle, and he hadn't cleaned their stables in 30 years. And Hercules went to Aegeus and offered to clean his stables in one day. not mentioning the fact that he had been told to do this as a labour by Eurystheus. And he said, oh, Aegeus, I'll clean your stables if you give me 1/10 of your cattle. Aegeus, thinking he couldn't possibly accomplish this, but he'd get his stables partly cleaned, let him do that. And Hercules took one of Aegeus' sons, Phyleus, as his witness. And then he diverted two rivers, the Alpheus and the Peneus, through the stables, cleaning them within a day. Aegeus didn't like this, as you can imagine, and basically said, oh, it's I can't give you the reward because the rivers have done the cleaning for you. And also, you didn't tell me that you had been told to do this by someone else. You shouldn't have been accepting payment for a labor that had been imposed on you by someone else. And so Hercules, very fairly, killed Aegeus and all of his sons except for Phyleus, gifted the kingdom of Elis to Phyleus instead.
And then Phyleus ended up going all the way around the
world. Yes, it. And invented the passport. Yeah. And then on the ground where Hercules killed all of Aegeus' family, he inaugurated it as sacred ground and said the Olympic Games were to be celebrated there. So they're very much on fields of blood to this day. Olympian fields. And there is an Agatha Christie story, The Labour of Hercules. There's a book where Poirot, one of Poirot's many planned retirements, he says he's going to retire after he solves 12 cases that are likened to Hercules' 12 labours. And in the one that's linked to the Aegean stables, he's asked to help the Prime Minister, Edward Ferrier. Ferrier's predecessor was a guy called John Hammett, now Lord Cornworthy, who also happens to be Ferrier's father-in-law. And he's held up as an exemplary role model, but underneath that surface, it turns out he was involved in all sorts of dishonest share dealing, misusing party funds. It's a very far-fetched sort of idea, wouldn't happen today. And the revelations are about to be revealed by a tabloid called the X-Ray News, just at the time at which Ferrier is attempting to clean up public life. So obviously the news of his father-in-law's activities would reflect very badly on him. And Poirot is sort of lured into helping them by the Home Secretary, Sir George Conway, saying it's like the Aegean stables. At which point Poirot goes, ah, one of the arbitrary 12 things I've decided to do. I will get involved in this case. And so Poirot visits the editor of the X-Ray News. He refuses to, you know, retract the story or say he won't publish it. And soon afterwards, some news reports come out hinting at sex scandals involving Ferrier's wife, Dagmar. And she's cavorting with a South American gigolo named Ramon. And then there's Ferrier's...
Aren't all South American gigolos called Ramon?
Yeah, I think it's very much an entry rule.
I sort of think like there's, in the same way that Zorro is just, there's only ever one Zorro and it gets handed down generation on generation. The same with gigolos. There's only one South American gigolo. It's always called Ramon.
Yeah.
In order to become the next Ramon, you have to kill the preceding Ramon.
Yeah, Dread Pirate Roberts kind of style, yeah.
Yes, the Dread Gigolo Ramon.
As you wish.
Eventually, the Ferriers sue the X-Ray News for libel against Dagmar, and they call the Bishop of Northumbria as a witness, and he testifies that Mrs. Ferrier had been at his palace recovering on doctor's orders. And then the next witness is a Danish lady called Thelma Anderson, who bears a resemblance to Dagmar Ferrier. And she testifies that she was approached by a man who said he worked for the X-Ray News and that she was to be employed as a stand-in for a celebrity and was asked to appear in public places photographed with this chap called Ramon. She didn't realise he'd been impersonating Mrs. Ferrier. And so the Ferriers win their libel case. It's clear the X-Ray News have employed this double and made it look like Mrs. Ferrier was involved in some sort of saucy scandal, but she wasn't. And then Poirot reveals that he himself had hired Thelma Anderson. Dagmar was in on the plan, and Poirot had come up with the idea of blackening Mrs. Ferrier's name first of all, and then clearing it publicly, resulting in the wave of sympathy for the Ferriers. So now, if the stories about Lord Cornworthy are published, the public will just dismiss it as yet another smear campaign. So well done, Poirot, for seemingly clearing the name of a really terrible politician who was legitimately a bad person. It's one of the lesser known Agatha Christie stories, that one, because literally Poirot goes into Tory HQ and goes, well, listen, we'll get her pregnant, Boris, and that'll make you look better when all of the other stuff comes out.
Need an independent inquiry.
Yeah. But my world's worst cleaner, you Google world's worst cleaner, you get all sorts of like sewer cleaning jobs and all of these things. And I thought, well, which cleaning job would I least want to have? That was my metric. And I came up with the window cleaners at the Burj Al Khalifa.
Amazing.
But Paddington makes it look like so much fun when he cleans that big skyscraper.
Right, I know. The Burj is the tallest building in the world, as I'm sure many of our listeners know.
I'm sorry, I can't have you shortening its name. Like, referring to it as the Burj makes it sound like some bloke you went to public school with.
Yeah, Burgie. Burgie's the tallest guy in our class. He was the second row. He was the second row. The Burj Khalifa is the tallest building in the world, completed in 2009. It is 828 metres tall, or if you can't envisage that, 276 elephants on top of one another.
Thank you, yes.
African or Indian elephants?
Doesn't 276 elephants whose average height adds up to 828 metres tall if you put them all together. So whichever one that is.
Okay, I'm suddenly thinking now that the architect of the Burj Khalifa was watching some of the key scenes from Dumbo and had a very different takeaway to the rest of us.
He forgot to put in elevators because he thought they'll just be able to fly up to the top of it.
Of course. Hey, do you think that Dumbo used his magic feather to clean up the chomets in the circus the night before? Never mind.
There are 24,348 windows on the Burj Khalifa. And for some reason, they're not self-cleaning windows, which is a thing.
Okay.
You can coat windows with titanium dioxide, which is a white powdery compound of titanium. If you coat it ultra thin, 10 to 25 nanometers deep, it reduces the light passing through the glass by no less than 5%. And it also is a photocatalyst, so it actually reacts to UV light. And when UV light hits titanium dioxide, it generates electrons, which turn water molecules into things called hydroxyl radicals, which basically attack dirt. So when light hits this compound on glass, it makes the compound attack dirt. Not only does it do that, it also makes the glass water-loving rather than water-repelling.
So hydrophiliac instead of hydrophobic.
Hydrophilic instead of hydrophobic, exactly. Yep. So instead of the water running down in little droplets, it actually spreads the water across the glass like a big watery cloth. And so you've got these things which are attacking dirt and making water spread. So if it rains, it basically squeegees your window without streaks.
Why aren't we making everything out of this material that destroys dirt?
Yeah, exactly. Instead of literally getting a team of 36 people to work at 820 meters off the ground. And it is ridiculous. They just literally go out there with the most low-tech soap in buckets and squeegees bungee jumping down the side of the building.
Is that because the position of window cleaner in Dubai is held in about as much esteem as the position of stadium builder in Qatar?
Actually, no. Apparently, this team get paid approximately $50,000 each. You'd fucking hope so.
Well, yeah.
They've to work pretty much every day of the year because cleaning the tower takes 3 months and you have to do it four times a year. So it's like painting the fourth bridge. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I assume that once they're finishing the Burj Khalifa, they then have to go and paint the fourth bridge.
Yeah. They do have some unmanned machines that clean the higher inaccessible areas of the building. But you can find photos of them online. They are fully hanging on the side of the building.
Could have given some sponges to Tom Cruise in that movie when he jumped off. That would have made that.
Yeah, right.
Top, wouldn't it?
There are obviously lots of dangers to it apart from the falling. There's the heat off the glass is obviously phenomenally hot. Sandstorm, literal sandstorms. The wind, if the wind is anywhere above 12 knots, that's about 14 miles an hour, then Amar Dubai, who managed the building, they say it's safe to work at 20 knots, but basically any worse than 12, they don't risk it. But just looking at the photos of these people hanging off the tallest building in the world with their buckets and sponges and squeegees.
I like the thought of Rory McIlroy playing at the Dubai Open golf tournament and going, now which way is the wind going? Oh, I'll just look at the window cleaners blowing on the top of the
See which way they're flapping,
See
yeah.
Which way they're flapping, yeah.
So I have thought about this in a few different ways. I thought of, well, where is a place that is dirty but we're not doing a very good job of cleaning? So I sort of looked into that, and it turns out space is very dirty and cluttered, yeah. and we're doing a really terrible job of cleaning it up. There's loads of space junk and debris up there. There's old satellites when they go out of commission that just kind of get left up there and start falling apart, and it can be really dangerous. There was a collision a few years ago, the Iridium Cosmos collision between an old Russian satellite and a communications satellite, and there's just kind of loads of junk up there.
The thing is that because it's in space, because you're calling it space junk, it immediately sounds cool.
Yeah,
yeah, I know, exactly. Space
debris. Like space age, anything with space in front of it is immediately awesome, yeah.
Yeah, just put space in front of anything and it does sound cool.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be better if, you know, if you two are getting feedback on the first draft of one of your plays?
Yeah, sure.
And you're like, oh, God, I don't want this. But if someone goes, hey, Tati, I've got some space notes for you.
Let's yeah, tell me.
Lay them on me.
Listen, you got space 2 stars. You've been space rejected. Yeah, okay, well, I can get on board with it.
Apparently there's 23,000 pieces of debris larger than a softball orbiting planet Earth.
It's too many. Do you know what I mean? That sounds like, I mean, I'm not, listen, this is a surprise. I'm not an astronaut, but that sounds like too many.
That's as many windows as there are in the Burj Al Khalifa. So,
what a beautiful bit of synchronicity.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's this problem called the Kessler syndrome, which is at a certain point, it gets to a critical mass of space debris, where if there is a collision, the fallout from that collision will create loads of other collisions, which will create other collisions until it's just a big explosion up there.
Space and explosion.
You have to listen. You have to stop doing PR for the space junk, Barry. This is terrible.
Space dominoes. It's going to be like that.
Space dominoes. And there's just so much stuff up there. And we're not really very good at clearing it up. There are some new movements to get rid of the stuff. Some people have got some ideas. But to me, they sound also kind of terrible or frightening. Well, they're just going to open up a whole other can of space worms. So the European Space Agency...
Hey, listen, it's all well and good talking about space worms, but you don't want the makers of Dune to be coming for you, so just be careful.
Yeah, no, I don't want Denis Villeneuve knocking on my door. Maybe I do, he's got a very cool voice. Yeah, so the European Space Agency have a mission called E.D. Orbit. Very cool, guys, well done. To send a robot up into space. But they're going to give it huge robotic tentacles, and there's something about creating a robot octopus and sending it into space and then feeding it satellites that just sets the sci-fi horror nerd in me a little bit on edge. Like, it's going to get irradiated by a solar flare and it's going to come back to Earth to wreak havoc on the scientists who created it and then cast it into a void. I just feel like the space debris is going to be the least of our worries.
Yeah, these are clearly scientists who haven't watched Spider-Man 2.
Exactly. So I think, I find that quite scary that there's all this dirt up in space. We don't fully have a plan on how to clean it. And the plans we do have really are sowing the seeds of our own inevitable destruction at the hands of a space Cthulhu.
What we need to do is send 6-year-old Ben up there with a feather and a candle.
Yes. Okay.
And you know what? I know what you're thinking. Oh, how dangerous. But actually, because space is a vacuum, that candle won't be lit. So actually, Ben, you won't burn yourself. Thank you, you're welcome.
Well, it's funny you talk about vacuums, because that brings me on to my next point. Seamless, bloody seamless. Yeah, I thought about worse, and I thought, well, okay, who is there a morally bad cleaner? And that led me inevitably on to the billionaire hypocrite and dust baron, James Dyson.
Dust baron.
And I do recommend, I really cannot recommend enough to your listeners to take a moment now to go onto his Wikipedia page and just have a little look at the photo of James Dyson on his Wikipedia page, because it is inexplicable. I don't know what he is wearing. I have so many questions about this shirt that he's chosen, about the collar, about the lapel situation. It's James just,
Dyson. Oh, it's so odd. To talk you through it, it looks like, were it not for what he was wearing, it would be a normal corporate chief executive photograph. He's wearing a navy blue jacket, a very boring tie, a white shirt with red collars on
blood it. Red collar.
And I mean an enormous red collar. It's large.
Do you know what it is? He's forgotten to change out of his ceremonial shirt from the stonecutters meeting.
That's
he's
so
just been
true.
To.
Yep, he was feeding children to the Henry Hoovers in the basement and had to change out of the robes. Just so right.
You know, they may say that Hooray Henrys are guys with loads of double chins.
Yes.
Our Henry Hoovers guys are just really long noses.
Yeah, I like
that. That's what happens to people who went to private schools. Hard body parts.
I thought that Dyson was a good person to talk about this because he talks a lot about failures. He has this like line in his motivational speeches that it took him 5,000 failures to get to the success of his cyclonic separation technique. And I feel like if he was counting his moral failures in that number, then the number would be much, much higher.
Yeah. Yeah. He and you don't really share the same approach to driving tests then.
No, absolutely. Listen, if I were in charge of inventing Hoovers, it would just be me going around with my fingers, just picking things up. We wouldn't have progressed. We wouldn't have progressed at all. There'd be no Henry.
We'd You'd have a tatty in every house.
Yeah, just me going, oh, I'm going as fast as I can, you guys. Terrible. He, in 2008, I believe, made a big sort of song and dance in the press about how terrible tax avoidance is and how any company who partakes in tax avoidance should be shunned. And then it was revealed that his own company has an incredibly complex shell structure with cases in Malta and in the Isle of Man. He campaigned very vociferously for Brexit and spoke at great length about how great Brexit was going to be for British businesses, then moved his company headquarters to Singapore. Yeah, so at the risk of getting satirical on the pod, it's like, it's just nice when someone who invents vacuums sucks so much. Before anybody writes in, I know that's not how they work. I know this, that they blow and they make a vacuum. Calm down, nerds. It's a joke. I know how
it's
work.
Fine. Luckily, he is also a moral vortex as
there
well.
We go. Yeah.
He's one of those people, I seem to remember about 10 years ago, after he'd sort of said that stuff about tax avoidance, everyone was like, oh, isn't it great to have like billionaires like James Dyson and J.K. Rowling who really take appropriate moral stands on the issues?
This probably won't go in the podcast, but the school that we just went to look out for our son, they had a house system. There are four different houses, yeah. And the houses were named after prominent people that the children can aspire to throughout history. See if you can spot the massive clanging odd one out.
Oh, God.
There's Mandela House.
Okay, yeah.
There's Carlo House. There's Einstein House. And there's Rowling House. And I'm going to say, even without her problematic views, she ain't,
I know.
She ain't really up there with the first three, is she?
Wow. This shows how you really got to scrape the barrel for inspirational white people to name your houses and your schools after Rowling's their choice. We got to up our game.
Yeah, I'm
we're flagging.
But maybe they were naming it after Ian Rowling, the Australian sprint canoeist who competed at the 1992 Summer Olympics and got a bronze medal.
Oh, do you know what? That's probably it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next go-to.
Yeah. But my contender for the worst cleaner is a man called James Howells, who himself is not a cleaner, he's an IT consultant, but he was doing a bit of cleaning in his study in 2013, and he threw away an old dusty hard drive and realized his mistake quite quickly when he remembered that that hard drive contained 7,500 Bitcoin, which today would be worth £275 million.
No!
And it's bad enough throwing something away and kind of not knowing where it is, that it's gone, it's in the ether. But he knows exactly where it is. It's in a landfill in Newport, South Wales. And he's working with a hedge fund. He's got AI technology to scan this landfill and find out where it is. He's ready to go. He's got the money. He's got the finance. He's got the gear. Newport City Council won't let him in. Which is hilarious. I love it. They're going, oh, yeah, 275 million, is it? You're not allowed in. Coincidentally, we've all got yachts now. Like, they have got in there. They've dug up that hard drive. They are living the life of Riley. They're not letting him in. And I just love it. I think it's beautiful.
Also, can that be the 21st century needle in a haystack?
Yes.
Bitcoin hard drive in a junkyard.
The Bitcoin in the junkyard. Yeah, I love it. I just love it because the amount of money is so unrelatable. But that feeling is so relatable. Like, remember when fibers used to disintegrate in water and you'd see the fiber going around in the washing machine and think, oh no, it's like that, except instead of a washing machine it's a landfill in South Wales, and instead of a fiber it's 55 million fibers. Like, it's just,
it feels like the perfect end of a movie, just this man on his hands and knees scrabbling through a junkyard and then yelling to the heavens as the camera zooms out and out and out and out.
Yeah, scrabbling through filth to find a currency that doesn't really exist in any tangible way. It's a real metaphor, I feel, for like 21st century Britain. The treasure hunt is just rooting through 300,000 tons of waste.
That is absolutely tremendous.
I don't understand how Bitcoin works, because I thought So it's all digital, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, so it's transferred.
grandkids gather around and tell granddad how your money works.
So it's digital, but it's transferred peer-to-peer, so like user to user, and it gets registered to a specific, called like a private key, and that will exist in like one place. People are going to write in and get cross with me for getting this wrong. This is my like playwright's understanding of a subject.
Yeah.
Once that private key is lost, there's no way of getting it back. So he had that private key saved to that hard drive, and he hasn't got he hasn't got a copy of it anywhere else. Yeah, there's no other way of getting to that private key other than where it is on this hard drive. So once it's gone, it's gone. And this isn't, he's not alone in this. That as of 2018, they reckon 20% of all the Bitcoin in the world is lost. And if you added all of that up, it would be $20 billion. And that was in 2018, so it's probably more today. Just like behind the sofa, do you know what I mean? Just out there somewhere.
I think I want to put a pitch to you guys now. I know I'm in the presence of too many talented writers.
Let's go.
Indiana Jones and the Hunt for the Lost Bitcoin.
Just him in a library, just pressing refresh, refresh, refresh.
Indiana Jones and the non-fungible tokens.
Shut up and take my money.
Truly, this is the cryptocurrency of a carpenter.
So, first of all, I similarly look for what are the most disgusting cleaning jobs. And this is not necessarily a cleaner, but someone who is finding things amongst the muck of Victorian London. So there was all sorts of people who would go to rubbish heaps and junkyards and try and find little things that they could sell. And because I'm talking about it 200 years ago, it's quite cheery, and it's best not to think about all the people currently doing that in Indonesia and India right now. But in Victorian London, there was a particular name for them. They were called toshers. And toshers would be young men. Oh, I say young men, probably 6 to 10 year olds who thought, being a chimney sweep looks too boring for me, who would go down into the sewers and they would sift through raw sewage to find any valuables that had fallen down the drain. And there is a modern version of that, and it is called being the Tory party chairman. And it was so dangerous, not just because of the raw sewage, but because of the swarms of rats that they could be swept away by the sluices being opened. And there was even deadly pockets of noxious fumes that could be explosive. But it was worth it for the toshers, because they would walk around with these trousers and jackets and aprons with all sorts of different pockets for them to stash and sort their booty in, with a lantern strapped to their chest as well to light them up in this gloom. And they would get all sorts of incredible treasures that they would either sell to various dealers, or they would retrieve all sorts of coins that were just lost down the sewers. Or very often, the most lucrative model for them was that they would find bits of cutlery that they would then go and buff and shine up and sell back to cutlery salesmen. It's such an iconic role. They turn up in various bits of literature. My favourite one being Terry Pratchett wrote a reimagining of the Artful Dodger story, in which Dodger starts out as the best tosher in London. It's a very pleasing word and a very pleasing subculture. Yeah. For what I imagine was a thoroughly disgusting thing.
Is Tosher's the sequel to Fluffers?
Yeah. Because I think we've mentioned gong farmers on the show before, and there were pure finders as well, was a term for people who would go around the streets, usually after like horses pulling carriages and things like that, and pick up their dung and dog poo especially, and sell it to tanneries for making leather and so on.
I feel like that was there a real turf war then between like the toshers and the mudlarks, like, oh, the mudlarks are like fair weather scavengers.
I mean, I think we all want to see a Victorian London reimagining of West Side Story between the toshers and the mudlarks.
Absolutely.
Obviously, very hard to click your fingers when they're covered in. Next, I found someone, I don't know if she's the worst cleaner, but I'm quite fond of what she did. But in 2015, in an art gallery in Italy, there was an artwork named Where Shall We Go Dancing Tonight? And the room was basically trashed and full of streamers and knocked over champagne bottles and the detritus of a party. There were cigarette butts everywhere, confetti. and the museum had to reinstall the artwork after an over-enthusiastic cleaner mistook it for rubbish and cleaned it up and threw it away.
Good for
her. Amazing.
Exactly, good for her. The museum had to apologise to visitors following the incident, saying, well, we've had some bad luck with a new cleaning lady. I thoroughly disagree. Yeah. That cleaning lady has done some incredible performance art there.
That's so interesting. I found a story about a similar incident in Dortmund with a piece of art by an artist called Martin Kippenberger called When It Starts Dripping From the Ceiling, that was included a rubber bucket that was all dusty and grimy on the sides. And it's interesting, you said over-enthusiastic. The Guardian describes this cleaner as overzealous, which is an extraordinary word for a woman who cleans dirty things, but it is her job to do it.
Yeah.
So I think solidarity of these cleaners who are being, their reputations tarnished for doing their jobs.
She saw a mess. She tidied it up. Job done. I next had a look at the notion of cleaners as in like mafia fixers. Particularly like Harvey Keitel's character in Pulp Fiction of Winston Wolfe. And to be honest, I couldn't really find much about any particularly bad fixers. But you'll be unsurprised to know that the path that the character of Winston Wolfe went on became quite controversial. Now, any non-British listeners might not know this, but he's the cleaner who comes along and helps out Jules and Vince after they've accidentally blown the head off Marvin all over a car. And he comes along and he sorts it all out. Now, about 20 years later, he turned up as a character in a Direct Line insurance advert in the United Kingdom. The reason being, I understand, is because Harvey Keitel got ponzied, essentially, like a lot of Hollywood stars.
Oh, he did a Kevin Bacon.
He precisely did a Kevin Bacon. It was so bizarre seeing not just a Hollywood A-lister, but such a brilliant, iconic character from a left-field pulp film turn up advertising car insurance. And it almost didn't happen. So the initial idea for using him came in a lift during an ideas meeting at the agency Saatchi & Saatchi. And one of the people present mentioned the thought of getting someone like the guy from Pulp Fiction. And then they went, no, we're going to get that guy. And they said that it was quite tough to sell the idea to the people at Direct Line because someone from the agency said, it's been described as a brave choice to choose a gangster to represent one of the least trusted industries in the world.
Yes.
The chief executive of Direct Line sort of went for a walk with someone from the ad agency saying, listen, Harvey's kind of old. We're in insurance. We've had issues with celebrities over the years. I'm just not sure this is going to be a good idea. To their credit, in the end, it worked really well from them, but they basically had to pay off Quentin Tarantino as well because he was not very happy about it. In fact, when he next met up with Harvey Keitel at the Cannes Film Festival, they had basically had it out about the virtues of using his character in a car insurance ad in the United Kingdom.
Oh, what a surprise. I'd have thought Quentin Tarantino would have been really chill.
Yeah.
But Winston Churchill's people were so happy about that dog, I don't
know. Yeah!
Yeah, but Adolf Hitler's were furious when they couldn't get their man into an insurance ad.
Do you know what? The image of Einstein is owned by a company.
I know. They've reanimated him for a company. I can't remember what the advert's for, but it's really
Yeah, there's an advert on British TV at the moment, which it's some clean energy thing or something. But they have a guy who's pretending to be Einstein, but at the bottom of the screen in the small print, they have like, oh, the image of Einstein licensed by such and such a company or whatever.
And Audrey Hepburn as well, now that they can, with this deep fake video technology, there was an Audrey Hepburn as well, where they kind of reanimated an Audrey Hepburn for an advert for something. Again, I can't remember what the advert was for, so it was clearly did its job very well. All I remember is being deeply disturbed by the reanimated ghost of Audrey Hepburn.
For my suggestion for the world's worst cleaner, we are going to a secure CIA facility.
Finally.
And within that facility is held someone called Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Do either of you know who Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is?
That's an Al-Qaeda name, isn't it?
He is, as far as we know, the principal architect of 9/11. and he has been kept under lock and key since his capture in 2003. He was in Guantanamo Bay for a bit, then he was in a secret, in inverted commas, Romanian facility operated by the CIA. And the problem the CIA have had for a long time with them is not just because of their various dubious interrogation techniques, but just because keeping someone like that locked up for so long, who is still to them a useful intelligence asset, is keeping them sane and keeping them engaged and maintaining their ability to remain in contact with the real world so that they are useful for them. So, according to a report in the summer of 2013, while Mohammed was an American captive in Romania, he requested an activity intended to keep his brain sharp and occupied in between interrogations. And according to a former senior CIA official, what he asked to do was to design a vacuum cleaner.
No.
He had, before he worked for Al-Qaeda, do I say worked for? I don't think they had, like, an HR department.
It's not on his LinkedIn, is it?
He has a mechanical engineering degree from North Carolina A&T State University, and he wanted permission to start drawing up schematics for a vacuum cleaner, which would, and I'm quoting the article here, almost certainly never be built. And in my mind, this is already like one of the opening scenes from the original Iron Man movie, where Stark is in that cave trying to build something for the terrorists, but is really building his way out of there. And
yeah,
you know, I imagine Sheikh Mohammed giving the blueprint for the vacuum cleaner over to the CIA and going, can you just build this for me? And the CIA are like, are you sure this isn't actually a bomb disguised as like, no, it's fine. It's not really known why he picked it, but his military assigned lawyer, a chap called Jason Wright, said that it would be in line with Mohammed's passions, which include a great interest in Islam and the Quran and marveling at modern cleaning technology.
That sounds the weirdest Tinder profile.
Is this why Dyson HQ has been moved overseas?
God, it could be, couldn't it?
I'm not saying it is, but I'm also not saying it's not.
No. you're definitely not saying something libelous. But you're also definitely not saying.
Not saying it. That's good, right? That's good. We can clear that with legal later.
Yeah, that's good. I think the worst foot forward lawyers are all over that.
Yeah, all absolutely fine with that. So, I mean, I suppose it had a noble reason, this design, to stop one of the most evil men in the world going nuts so he could continue to hopefully help us prevent further terrorist attacks. But it's definitely the most evil vacuum cleaner ever designed.
Are you imagining a Henry Hoover, but with like... like glaring eyes, furrowed brow.
Yeah, I'm going for a Henry Hoover, but with the evil eyes from the New Labour, New Danger advertising in the mid-90s.
I would still find it cute. I'd still throw a funeral for it when it broke.
Well, you'd have to have, I'd expect like a 21 Hoover salute. Just the last post played on a Henry Hoover. Our nominees for the world's worst cleaner are Barry's of the job of the window cleaner at the Burj in Dubai, Tati's nomination of James Howells, the IT consultant who lost £275 million somewhere in a junkyard in Wales, and my nominee of the architect of 9/11, who is also the architect of an as-yet-unmade vacuum cleaner, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
This poor IT consultant lumped into the same basket as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Oh my! I mean, we kind of jumped the shark there with the architect of 9/11.
I'm told it's not going to be the window cleaners at the Burj Khalifa because it's a tricky job, but they're good men and women. They're doing a good job. They're well compensated. I love mine, but I love yours, Tati, as well. the narrative of both of them are glorious, and I don't know this. There's something so wonderfully absurd about that they have kept the architect of the greatest act of modern terrorism sane by letting him design a vacuum cleaner. And the fact that obviously he created one of the most infamous messes of all time in the rubble of the Twin Towers.
Oh God.
The thing that they've let him design is this. Come on, that psychologically there's something going on here. Going, I shall blow up the Twin Towers. What do you want to make to keep you busy? A vacuum cleaner.
No, I don't know how Worst Foot Forward legal I got to deal with this one.
So it's either that or your, because your guys did, he threw it away. So yeah. It was basically yours as a spring clean gone wrong.
He had like a little hard drive. He was dusty. Thought, oh, it's an old computer. It's dusty. I'll throw it out. Spring cleaning, off it goes.
The spring clean that cost $250 million.
Yeah. It's why I don't do any cleaning.
It's a good excuse. Yeah, this could be costly.
Can't afford it, you know?
It feels such bad form to pick my own. And so as much as I love mine, I'm going to go for yours, Tati.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Because the gut punch that the guy must have felt of having chucked away all of this money when trying to be doing some good cleaning.
Really like the fact that, you know, the way when you lose something and people go, oh, well, it must be the last place you look. Newport Town Council aren't letting him look
there. I know. In my mind, he's just staring through a chain link fence. And all the rubbish being poured forlornly looking through.
A seagull pulling at some wires in a pile somewhere and looking at him and its eyes narrowing. Duh, duh, duh.
Wearing a really fancy little monocle and hat.
Yes!
So by the narrowest of margins,
very kind.
Tati's suggestion beats one of the most evil men of all time. Before we go, it is time for the happiest news of the week, which we shall continue long until the 2030s, when the horrors of COVID have been replaced by the climate catastrophe. This week, we go to Wales, where some rabbits have turned amateur archaeologist. So Richard Brown and Giselle Eagle, who are wardens of a small island called Skokholm, which I'm going to say is clearly a small knockoff of the Swedish capital, spotted some rabbits diggering around in... Around in some pebbles. And it turns out that the rabbits had found some remnants of some 9,000-year-old Stone Age tools and shards of a 3,750-year-old cremation urn. And it would not have been found if it weren't for their little bunny accomplices.
Wow. So,
because I just thought the idea of little watership down archaeological digs.
Are they going to put them in the National Herstory Museum?
Get out.
Wa-da-ba-ba-da-bap.
Yes, Barry. Yes, they are.
Good. I hope they do.
So whilst our listeners are recovering from the internal hemorrhaging that pun caused, Tati, where can our listeners find you and what they find you doing when they get there?
I'm on Twitter, trying not to be on Twitter, at Tati Hennessy. I'm very bad at not being... That's another thing I fail at, is not being on Twitter. So you'll find me there very frequently talking about theatre and television.
Marvellous stuff. Well, we are all off to the patent office to find out about Peter Sutcliffe and his curtain cleaning technology. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.